Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and progressive action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman.
The problem that we now have created for ourselves is that we have so many rural communities that now perceive themselves as being dependent on prison industries, and so many more rural communities that are being driven by the perception that prisons are going to be their economic panaceas.
For all its Wall Street buzziness, the term economic restructuring may actually come closest to describing the primary effect of the information age. Not since the Industrial Revolution have so many families, businesses, and organizations struggled to adapt to a changing economic paradigm. Even the Internet, with all its early success and accompanying enthusiasm on Wall Street, is only the latest new development in the gradual shift towards information technology witnessed globally over the course of 30 years. But while the Dow Jones continues to soar, rural America is experiencing an economic downswing that started with the demise of small family farms in the 1950s. Crushed by conglomerates and large agribusiness, people gave up their land and moved to the cities in search of jobs. Gradually, produce prices fell, unemployment rose, and large businesses were replaced by national chain stores. Rural America was well on the way to becoming the land of the economically depressed. Enter the prison industrial complex. Today on Bruderhof Radio, we'll examine how the promise of jobs and economic security gave rise to a wave of prison building in the United States. We'll talk about the effects prisons have on local economies, and how some are fighting to keep these supposed economic saviors from entering their towns. Tracy Hewling is a filmmaker from upstate New York. She recently produced a documentary titled Yes, in My Backyard, in which she examines the response of one community, the Hudson Valley town of Coxsackie, New York, to its own maximum security prison. We spoke with her about the film. Let's start with maybe an obvious question about the name of your film. I think, you know, in the 1980s, the buzzword was not in my backyard, with things like prisons and nuclear reactors and garbage dumps, but obviously things have changed. Your film is called Yes, in My Backyard. Why the 180-degree turnabout? Why do towns, especially rural towns in the Hudson Valley, want prisons at this point?
Well, rural towns in the Hudson Valley are like rural towns across America. In the 1980s, there was the combination of the farm crisis, which put many family farms out of business, and the sort of wholesale leaving of factories and manufacturing operations as they were relocated overseas. So there was a tremendous decline in, good employment in these areas. You know, employment which paid good wages and good benefits. And then at the same time, we had a huge influx of prisoners starting to come into the prison system as a result of harsh sentencing laws that were passed not only in New York but across the country. So the rural communities at that point began to look at prisons as economic development.
So this is a national trend. This is not only happening in New York and in California but across the country?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, since 1980, the majority of prisons built in this country have been put in rural communities.
Now, let's talk a bit about the economic benefits that are supposedly coming out of the prisons. What are towns seeing will happen when a prison decides to build in their backyard?
Well, the perception, and that is primarily what's driving the desires of rural communities to lobby for prisons at this point, the perception is that they're going to receive, lots of good jobs, which will take care of the unemployment rates in the areas, that there will be multiplier effects from a prison coming into an area. That is, that the prisons will attract other kinds of businesses and that the dollars will flow through the local economy. That's the perception. And that is, at this point, what is driving, you know, small town mayors like the mayor of Coxsackie, New York, which is the town that I profiled in my film. That's what's driving those mayors to lobby their county legislators, who in turn lobby state legislators for not only building new prisons, but placing them in their backyards.
So are these prisons actually attracting other businesses? For instance, in the town of Coxsackie, which you studied in your film, is this happening?
Well, from what, and again, there's been no, I should say that this trend, since it's fairly new and we've just begun to see the effects of 20 years of building in rural communities, there's not been a whole lot of longitudinal studies or, you know, looking at prisons, the impact of prisons on local communities in the long term. But what we do have is a lot of anecdotal information that's beginning to develop, which indicates that, yes, prisons do attract a certain kind of business into the community. And though that kind of business typically are the fast food chains, the regional or national chains, the Walmarts, the McDonald's, they tend to locate in a prison town. The problem with that over the long term is that what we're hearing from people on the local level is that that kind of business has had is beginning to have a depressing effect on local family-owned businesses, the sort of Main Street small-time entrepreneurs who can't compete with the larger national and regional chains.
As Hewling notes, changes in legislation that affect prison population has spurred new construction not only in New York, but across the United States. Craig Gilmore works for the California Prison Moratorium Project, a grassroots organization that opposes the rapid prison expansion currently underway in California. Gilmore says that while prisons are often lauded as economic boons, his experience shows otherwise.
It's paid off in virtually none of the California towns. California's built 23 prisons in the last 18 years. And the state government plans to build four more in the near future. A number of the towns in which prisons were built in the mid to late 80s and early 90s now don't want a second prison. That is, they've seen that the promises that were made have not come true. The city of Avenal, which is a city that has about 4,000 or 5,000 had about 4,000 or 5,000residents, now has twice that many because half of them are incarcerated, hasn't had an increase in the number of people living in town. The sales tax revenue for the town have actually dropped almost 20% since the prison opened. Virtually all the guards in the state system transfer in. They don't hire people from the local towns. And those that moved to the new prison didn't live in Little Avenal. They lived 30, 40, 50 miles away and commuted. And that's been true of virtually every town that's had a new prison go in. Some of the towns in which there actually was some growth, for example, Tehachapi, California, it's an old prison town. It's had a prison since the 1930s, but 10 years ago, that prison doubled in size. And the growth of the town actually brought in some, made the town big enough that suddenly it was a place that some of the national chains went in. And as a result of that and other things happening in Tehachapi, over 700 local businesses have gone out of business in the last 10 years. And the people who worked in those businesses and owned those businesses now, I mean, the alternative for them is now working as managers, assistant managers, or clerks at fast food restaurants or Kmart or Walmart. The only local economic sector that we've been able to identify that actually does benefit in any substantial way are realtors. Because there is, you know, there are some people moving in and out of town. If new businesses do come into town, someone has to broker the land deal. But none of the other local businesses, as far as we can tell, are benefiting.
Faced with mounting evidence that suggests many prisons are failing to make good on their promise of economic benefits, several towns in California are reconsidering the prospect of accepting state correctional facilities. Tehachapi, the town Gilmore refers to, has been the home of California correctional institutions since the 1930s. The prison was expanded twice in the mid-1980s and now holds 6,000 inmates. Then, in December 1998, a local journalist uncovered a secret city council plan to invite a state mental hospital for sexually violent predators to the town. Painfully aware that the previous expansion had done little for the local economy, business owners in Tehachapi banded together and successfully forced the government to rescind their offer. This local business owner, who asked that her name not be used, helped spearhead that effort. Why were you opposed to this new institution being built in your town?
Well, we didn't think that we wanted Tehachapi to become the sexually violent predator capital of the world. It's just the connotation. When you think of Cedro Woolley, Washington, Atascadero, Bellevue, New York, I mean, these names connotate the mental hospital. And Tehachapi, this thing will, whenever it's, wherever it's cited, it's going to be touted as the new big thing. The world is going to know that this is where the sexually violent predators are. So it seemed like common sense that this is not something we wanted, particularly if we want to stress and try to get a tourist industry going.
Now, you mentioned that it seems, at least to you, like common sense that you wouldn't want such a mental institution in your town. And you mentioned also that Tehachapi is interested in tourism. Why then is your city council, or was your city council, so supportive of getting this institution in there? What is the positives of such a thing coming to your town, at least in the eyes of the mayor and so forth?
Well, the state is marketing these institutions to small town America as economic development. And the problem is that once you get one, our city right now is, they're feeling a sense of desperation, and they think there'll be jobs. The jobs that will be there are for, and that was one of the selling points for us, is it will give us jobs for our children so they won't have to leave the community and go elsewhere. Well, I don't know about you, but I don't really want my daughter being at 20 years old being a med tech in a mentalist institution with sexually violent predators. I happen to have a very beautiful young woman, and that's not what I have in mind for her. The other thing is that as the state promises us jobs, but it doesn't pan out that way when they come around to it, our local people aren't qualified. So the job thing is really a mirage. It does not pan out. Also, because what a prison does is it adds people. It doesn't add a product that's sold in the community. It does not buy from the community. It buys from state vendors. And the unfortunate thing is nobody thinks of the long haul. They think of the immediate gain.
In a way, the outrage over Tehachapi's proposed mental hospital is no surprise. Still, it's not for any lack of sensitivity, but rather sheer economic desperation that drives many towns across America to welcome such institutions. Henry Rausch is the mayor of Coxsackie, New York, the town in Tracy Hewling's documentary, Yes, in My Backyard. Over half of the population of his small town live behind bars in two separate correctional facilities, one built in 1935 and one in 1983. He says that while the reputation of being a prison town is not always favorable, he, for one, couldn't be more pleased.
The prisons provide good jobs, equal opportunity, employer, of course, good salaries, benefit package, second to none, and your chances for advancement are great. I mean, you can go from a correctional officer or a entry-level stenographer all the way up to the top, and that's been proven time and time again. 4 years ago, of course, the prison uses a lot of our sewer services, so when we upgraded our sewer plant, they paid for that upgrading totally, and that came to a total of $2.7 million, which the Department of Correctional Services paid for. Right now, we're going through a $5 million water project, $4.9 million water project to be exact. The County of Greene, the Town of Coxsackie, and the Village of Coxsackie, and the Department of Correctional Services are partners on that project and the Department of Correctional Services put $1.7 million into that project. So they pay their fair share. And other people say we wouldn't have to make these upgrades if they weren't using so much of our services. So there are two ways of looking at it. But if they weren't here in the first place, our infrastructure would still be getting older by the day. It would still have to be upgraded. So I, as mayor, would much rather have the Department of Correctional Services presence in the community than not have them.
Taken at face value, the New York Department of Corrections efforts on behalf of Coxsackie are indeed impressive. Still, as Tracy Hewling is quick to point out, their generosity was not entirely altruistic.
There's a context to that story. The context is that for 7 years, the sewer system was overloaded by the prison, and they were dumping sewage into the Hudson River that was not properly treated. And it wasn't until the Department of Environmental Preservation got involved and cited this system for being out of regulation that there was pressure put on the department to do something about it. So 7 years worth of polluting the river and could be, you know, other kinds of groundwaters around it, produce that. I mean, they had to do something, and the town couldn't afford it.
You're listening to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly radio program focusing on progressive thought and activism. We'd like to hear from you if you have questions or comments about today's program. Give us a call toll-free at 800-778-8461 or visit us on the internet at www.freespeech.org/Bruderhof. When examining the issue of rural prison building, it's hard to ignore the rather dubious connection between rising inmate populations and the demand for new prisons. Craig Gilmore of the California Prison Moratorium Project has studied this relationship and insists that there is a reason why inmate populations have risen steadily in California for the last 20 years. One of these reasons, he says, is harsher sentencing laws, proposed in the state legislature by representatives looking to attract prisons to their rural districts.
The decision to build more prisons in California happened in the early 80s. The prisons started to be built in 83 and 84. The first set of laws, state laws, that really bumped up the prisoner population were a series of laws around the kind of hysteria around inner-city gangs that happened in the mid to late 80s. And then that's been followed by stronger state drug sentences, the three strikes laws, and most recently Proposition 21, which just passed in March, which again sort of expands state conspiracy laws to make it easier and easier for people who are identified as members of gangs to be locked away for longer and longer periods of time. The towns for a while were begging for prisons, and laws are being passed and often sponsored by legislators from those rural districts in which, you know, gang activity is virtually unknown or was virtually unknown. So the people who are sponsoring a lot of the anti-gang legislation are people from districts in which there are no gangs, but districts in which there are prisons. The other major factor that's happened in California is that at a certain point, the prison guard union, just because of the rapid expansion of prisons, has become the biggest political contributor in the state. They support a number of victims' rights groups financially, and they are major lobbyists on behalf of all sorts of anti-crime legislation, meaning legislation that locks more people away for longer sentences.
Tracy Hewling agrees. She cites the so-called war on drugs as another example of legislation that perpetuates the cycle of crime and punishment in order to fill prisons.
We have been, you know, for the last, what is it, seven or 8 or 9 years, at least as, you know, as long as I've been here that I can remember, there have been, you know, there's been study after study that's indicated that New York has huge numbers of people incarcerated in its prisons for nonviolent low-level drug crimes. When Thomas Coughlin was the Commissioner of Corrections under Governor Cuomo, he would publicly talk about the fact that these people are inappropriate prisoners. They should not be in the system. So you've had a level of intellectual agreement on this issue for a long time, that these people do not belong in prisons. They belong in alternatives to incarceration programs. They belong in treatment programs. They don't need to be warehoused in our prisons at $30,000 a year per inmate. But we have not been able to move at all on legislation that would move toward decarcerating people who do not have to be there. So when you look at that situation and you realize that many of the people who are most staunchly supportive of the drug laws are also people who are representing the districts in which prisons are being built, you have to wonder. The problem that we now have created for ourselves is that we have so many rural communities that now perceive themselves as being dependent on prison industries, and so many more rural communities that are being driven by the perception that prisons are going to be their economic panaceas, that the pressure that this is creating on state legislators to do two things. One is to increase and continue the expansion of prisons, and then to continually criminalize more people to fill those prisons by passing harsh sentencing laws, drug laws, etc., which are criminalizing more and more people who are committing nonviolent crimes. It's a cycle that we've now created that's going to be tough to break.
And like any system affecting the lives of so many people, prisons bring with them a hidden social cost. Craig Gilmore explains.
We've talked to a social worker up in Susanville, where High Desert is, and incidences of spousal abuse skyrocketed after High Desert Prison opened up there. Alcoholism rates skyrocketed. I mean, there was a huge strain on those sorts of city social services and county social services. I mean, to me, the fact that prisons don't make economic sense is in some ways good news. I mean, I'm finding it, you know, that people are willing to hear that, and it makes sense to people once you explain it to them. It's very hard to gather any kind of reliable information. I mean, we've gathered all kinds of anecdotes, but when people want to talk about changing public policy, they want statistics so often. And the statistics are so unreliable, particularly when you're talking about domestic violence in households of, you know, police, sheriffs, or prison guards. The social worker up in Susanville pointed out to us that California law makes it impossible for someone who's been convicted of assault to carry a gun. So that any guard who was convicted in a domestic violence case would be forced out of his or her job. And the wives all know that. So if they call, even if they, you know, if they make a phone call, if they call the police because they're being beaten, you know, they stand to lose the income that supports the household.
What emerges is a picture of a society hopelessly addicted to the drug of prisons. Like any drug, prisons may produce an initial feeling of security, but the long-term economic and social repercussions are disastrous. Sadly, in more and more towns across the country, prisons are being accepted as part of the community. Tracy Hewling.
You know, you have to understand that the long-term political impacts of a prison on a community also create a situation where the prison interests begin to drive the community. They begin to sort of rule the community. And so over time, what happens is that you create an elite in the community by, through these jobs. And that those people tend to do what any elite in any community does. They get involved in local politics. They run for county office. So they begin to rule the community. They begin to become the authorities in the community, which, again, is a reason why it's so difficult for anyone to publicly speak out about any concerns they have. When my film was shown on the local public television station here, I got several calls from Coxsackie residents who were outraged that the mayor could be so sanguine about the benefits. And I asked them, well, where were you when I was shooting the film? And would you talk to people? Would you talk to reporters? Would you talk about this in public? Oh, no. Oh, no, we couldn't do that. My husband works for so-and-so, and, that organization is run by people who work at the prison, or my son works at the prison, or whatever it is. Everybody has a relationship with the prison.
That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio, a look at prison expansion and how it affects rural communities. For a more in-depth look at how the town of Coxsackie, New York, is affected by its two prisons, you can order Tracy Hewling's documentary, Yes in My Backyard, from Galloping Girls Productions by calling 518-634-2170. You can contact the California Prison Moratorium Project at 510-893-4648, extension 202. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman and Ben Wright. To order tapes and transcripts of Bruderhof Radio, call us at 1-800-778-8461. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount, in particular the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for. For more information, call 800-778-8461.